Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Strategy Hero podcast, the podcast that's all about diving into the world of business, strategy, transformation, and much, much more. Today, I'm joined by Jeroen Kuybrink, who is someone that really stood out to me as we were going through our guest list as someone that I just absolutely had to talk to. Jeroen is a famed speaker, Oxford University adjunct professor at the University of Amsterdam. He's the founder of Do Strategy and someone that has a very, I believe, important and fresh take on the world that we all know and love. So he's much more than that, but today he is our strategy hero. Jeroen, how are you?
Thank you, James, for this wonderful introduction. Glad to you call me a hero already. So let's stop this podcast now.
Well, it is genuinely my pleasure to talk to people like yourself, and I think that as I have learned more about you and as we talked prior to recording this episode, I think there is a lot of issues that we can go through that you have very important takes on that our audience should listen to. I think there's a lot that we can talk about with, the classic two-thirds of strategies fail in their execution, but it's more important to go deep and further than that number. And I think today I would love to hear your take on a number of issues, all the way from the importance of having a human-centered approach to strategy, to even touching on the opposite end, which is AI. But before we do that, for our listeners who perhaps haven't read your books, or have come across you on social media, which I would find hard to believe. He has a very, very big following, ladies and gentlemen. Could you just tell us a bit about your background and how you got started in the world of strategy and how you find yourself where you are today?
Sure. Once upon a time, I was a student. And after that, I went the academic route. So I did my PhD and found myself to become an assistant professor, associate professor. So basically, on the academic trajectory to becoming a full professor. And kind of halfway that process, I started to get some doubts and thinking, like, is this my career? Is this what I would like to do the rest of my life? And then the answer was no. And the main thing, I wanted to have a more direct, visible impact on the real world. So this is when I stepped out of academia for, let's say, with half a leg, not even one leg, but first try to pretend I was a strategy consultant. So that's what I did. I got my first client, my second client, and so on. So then I was a consultant. I've always been still connected to academic life, but far less than in the past. So gradually, really went my own way. Do consulting, mentoring, writing a couple of books, and as you already mentioned, very currently also very active on LinkedIn to share basically everything that I have learned over the past 20 plus years in these different roles about strategy, leadership, execution, and related topics, and share that with the world. And yeah, that's kind of what I do now. I sometimes say I do one thing that's strategy, but I also do as many different things as possible, which means mentoring, consulting, training, writing, and who knows? So one key core, and then a lot of variations. Otherwise, I get bored. So I need to do a lot of different things.
And this podcast is one of those things, and we are very grateful for you being willing to join us. You mentioned and I think a lot of our listeners who have gone through academia will know this, at least as a student. There's a difference between being a student and learning about business and then actually being a professional in a business environment. As you were switching from academia to, I guess, the reality of business life as a business professional and consulting, what was the biggest challenge for you going from perhaps theory to reality?
I think the biggest challenge was not the theory versus practice thing, but how I saw myself, and maybe also how others saw me. I know in some countries, being an academic, having a PhD is a good thing. Here in the Netherlands, where I'm from and where I'm located, that's not necessarily true. So once you have a PhD and have worked at a university, quite a few potential clients might see you as too theoretical, too academic, or too teacher or researcher alike, and therefore not equipped to work with real companies. And I think my own challenge of redefining basically who I was or what kind of professional I was, that has been, I think, the most important challenge. Because if I look, the whole reason why I basically left academia was because I found it too theoretical. So I did have, I think, quite good intuitions about how things were going on. And of course, at the university I worked there, we did work with quite some businesses in projects, in bigger and smaller projects. So I got to learn also the practical side already there. But this kind of change, shift in identity, and then over time, making that academic background part of my current identity and not rejecting it, not saying, okay, I leave it behind, but making it part and a valuable part to who I am today. I think that has been the my biggest challenge.
That's really interesting. I think that when you come across authors, and not just in business strategy, but I can think for myself as a marketer, when you come across authors that are theoretical, often their content is quite dense and it's not tightly aligned to the reality of what goes on in the world. Whereas on the opposite side, you find authors who are from, the day-to-day execution, and actually they're in a role around that subject area. They're sometimes skipping over the theory, the detail that is necessary. And I think finding that middle point, at least for me, as I've been engaging in your content, I feel like you found that sweet spot. How did you find your voice? You talk about finding yourself and finding, perhaps clients could have seen or have seen you as too theoretical at the start. How do you balance that out with finding your voice that finds you in that middle area?
Yeah, that's an interesting question also, especially to look back at how that has happened. And I think it's really about getting rid of all the things you were supposed to do or are expected. So it's kind of a liberation journey where, and it doesn't really matter, in my case, it's academia, but if you are, whatever your career is and whatever your background is, there's all kind of norms, values, habits, routines that define what is normal in your context. Everyone has that. So I've had that as well. And getting rid of what is normal in academia, there's no choice, because if you work with a business, the world is different. So yeah, getting and that's also in terms of writing, because you asked, how do I find my own voice? When you're trained as a student, and especially as a PhD student, you're trained to learn how to write an article. You're even recommended to find an article, a successful article by someone else, and basically copy the style, the structure, and so on. All of that I have to unlearn. And I think if you look at my books in sequence, so the oldest book is the Strategy Handbook from 2015, to the newest book today still is the 1 Hour Strategy. The next one is coming very soon. I think you see an evolution of style, which becomes much more me, more personal, where currently I don't care anymore what is appropriate or what one should write. And I think that you see that, and writing for LinkedIn has helped me. So writing LinkedIn posts has helped me a lot in that, because there is no expectation that there is like a peer review process, or that it's a serious publication in a serious journal where you put all kind of criteria and demands on yourself. No, it's just a post. So it's out there. If it doesn't work, people forget about it or ignore it anyway. So this very low threshold of getting my voice out into the open has really helped me to develop that voice, help develop my thinking, feel the liberty to to also share with others how I think. And one of the other points is also the fact that you feel and experience that what you write and what you post and what you say is actually appreciated by an audience. This is, I think, I find that very important, and I think many people find that important, that you see that you do have an impact, that you do get a positive response. So yeah, I think in combination, that has really helped me to year by year get closer to myself, to what I want to say about strategy, leadership, and related topics.
Looking through your CV, you can see quite a lot of important steps, I would imagine, in the evolution of you as an author, as a consultant. What sort of impact did your time speaking at the University of Oxford have upon you, and that voice and that ability to reach more people and reach them deeper than perhaps before?
Yeah, and so that was, to be transparent, that was just a small thing, like a small let's say speaking event. But it was important for me to also, for credibility, but also for confidence reasons. Like, in the beginning, I've worked with kind of small unknown brands, unknown companies. And yeah, then when you're asked to, for instance, for the University of Oxford or other, let's say, more well-known organizations, it confirms that what you have to say is probably interesting, because that's an audience with a lot of smart people. And if they would like to hear what you're saying, then yeah, that's a compliment or something nice to. So in that sense, it has helped to develop my, let's say, my confidence to speak out and share my views rather than just repeat what everyone else is saying.
I feel like every little step that we take is an important step. So whether you know you're very humble and you say it was a small engagement or it was something bigger, I think it's still important to have those steps along the way. And when we were talking before recording, we talked about the idea of finding your own way, and you talked a little bit about what perhaps was behind your drive towards academia and then towards where you are now. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about, I guess, the more personal side of what has pushed you into this path?
Yeah. I think one thing maybe good to know is that I have never had a very clear idea of where I wanted to go. And maybe reflecting on myself, maybe that's the whole reason I find strategy so interesting, because it's all about creating this future image. And I think that says a lot about me. Also, strategy is very much about kind of creating structure in the chaos, and this is something that I need. So this has been the my search for finding out what I like. So I had a very more an opportunistic way of developing my career. I did my master's, and then the opportunity was there to do a PhD. And I liked that. Maybe part of it because it was safe, it was still at the same university, but part of it was also like, okay, probably something I could be good at. I like to take a deep dive. I like to theorize. I like to create models to find patterns and so on. So those research skills and also the theory part, I like that. And I still like that. And you can also see that, I think, in what I do, the many in my books, but especially in the things I post on LinkedIn, there's always kind of concepts, there's some models, and a large share of them I've created myself. So I really like to play with some things I hear, some things I see, and then kind of discover like, hey, there's a pattern there, there's a structure, I can create an image of that, I can create a matrix. So this tendency to organize and categorize and link and theorize the things that I hear and see is something that I think that was very important as a student, or especially as a PhD student and as a researcher. It's still very important as a consultant, because I use the very same skills that I learned at the university for qualitative inductive research it's the way I work with my clients. I gather a lot of information and then try to detect patterns and structure that, and then give it, write it down and give it back to my clients. So it's this thing that's the more the content part that has drawn me towards what I'm doing. Also the, yeah, probably the importance. Strategy is, I find is, and I'm, yeah, we're in this, in the Strategy Hero podcast here, so I'm preaching to the converted probably. it's kind of the highest level in a company, encompassing everything. It's an integrated view, and that is also what I liked. And you can also clearly see when I've gone through various conferences, and then the strategy conferences are always a bit more elitist. Something even in the name, like the Strategic Management Society, that's the academic conference, you can see the elitist view. And I'm also kind of drawn to that because it's kind of the most influential part in a company. And at the same time, if you see it, what I'm doing, I try to really get that whole topic with 2 feet on the ground. So from, let's say, from the boardroom to the shop floor, if you like. Yeah, so I think that has been much more unconsciously than consciously has been my drive. And maybe that's another theme in what I do, is not overthink and overplan your career or your next step, but kind of follow your intuition, follow the opportunities that come your way, and then jump on those that, yeah, that feel good and that do match, and ignore those that do not match. So sometimes, and I've talked about this before, one metaphor for strategy, but also for my career, is that of surfing. I'm not a surfer, so I probably say it the wrong way, but I see kind of the world around us as the waves. There's all kind of waves coming your way. Some of them are good, some of them are not so good. You do have some idea where you want to go, but you there's only so many waves that you can pick, and you just pick the one that is kind of the next good thing. This is how I do my career, and this is also how I look at strategy. Long answer. I don't know. Did I answer your question?
No, it did, because I feel like as you were going through there are a couple of themes that bubble to the surface, and you know, for anyone who has come across Jeroen's work and the way he talks through his content, a message that pops up quite often is getting people engaged to execute strategy that they help create. And so when you were just talking there about sort of having intuition and being able to pick the right wave, it made me think to something that I ask some of our guests when they come on here, especially those that are in perhaps a similar space and role as you, Jeroen. Is it possible to instill the desire that you have about capturing chaos and making sense of it with your clients? Do you have a way to, okay, yes, you have helped them to identify that chaos and then plot a course through it. When you're having engagements with your clients, do you have a way to help them adopt your approach to that?
Yeah, very much. I think one very important way is the core tool that I've developed for this, the strategy sketch, which basically opens the black box of what strategy is. So, and this is also a result of my, let's say, my academic career, dissatisfaction with existing models, which were incomplete or not so useful, and then deciding, okay, I need to develop my own, because there is no model out there that captures what strategy is all about at a sufficient level of detail. So that's why I created the strategy sketch. And if people search it or even go to my LinkedIn profile, they'll find it on my website. But it's basically like the 10 elements of strategy on a single slide of paper, very much like the business model canvas, but then complete with all 10 elements that are part of strategy. And what I do with this model, the way I typically work with a client is through a series of sessions with a diverse group. So not just the board, but people representing the different levels and functions in the organization. So marketing, purchasing, R&D, production, whatever functions you have those in the room, like 10, 12 people, maybe slightly more, slightly less. And then the thing we do is use that sketch to first together understand the status quo. And I think that's where the alignment is starting, is let's just figure out what are we currently doing. And it's almost always surprising, not so much for me, but for the people participating, how different they think about the status quo. So there's questions like, okay, who are our most important customers? What is unique about our product and service? How do we create value? What does our revenue model look like? What are the most important competences we have? All kind of questions where people differ very much in how they look at this. So using this one model to define the status quo, to assess it, but also to redesign the strategy for the future, creates, I think, a very, very much structure in the process. It helps them understand themselves. It helps them understand what strategy is about. They can even place what others are saying. So for instance, when someone from sales is talking, it's clearly often related to the customer side. When someone from purchasing is talking, it's often related to the partner side, to the supplier side. When the controller is talking, it's usually about risks, cost, and revenues. So you can almost plot different people in that same picture. And it's a way to break silos, to have a good constructive dialogue about the company's strategy today and the future. So that's the part that I do with the client, where there's a lot of structure in the way they think. And what I aim to achieve with that is also competence development, so that after I've left, they still can do this better than they did before. The other part is the actual kind of creation of the first version of a strategy. That's what I do on my own. So I typically use these often 5-6 sessions with the team to gather all kind of data, judgments, or qualitative data often, their views on the status quo, what's good and bad about it. So there's different steps. So we go through this from different perspectives so that we get a very rich understanding of what the strategy is. And then it's my role to kind of connect the dots. And I think that's my skill as a strategist. And this is where my qualitative research skills and theorizing skills come in very handy, because you have 1,000 data points, and create the story that's in that the data. So I often see myself almost as a ghostwriter. So I listen, I talk to people, they tell me what they think, and they do that collectively in these sessions. I listen very carefully and really immerse myself as if I am the client, and then structure what they have said and give it back to them. So there's kind of two different ways in which structuring is a very important aspect of what I do.
And when you have developed the strategy and you've given them the framework essentially to mirror this in the future, how often do you find that the people that you work with, the clients you have, that they're capable of doing it by themselves without further supervision? Or do you need to come back and help them on a quarterly or biannual basis?
Yeah, the latter. Yeah, so I would hope for more, maybe more learning, more experience, but apparently it is something that is difficult, which is a good thing and a bad thing. It's a good thing because it makes sure that as a consultant, I have work. But it's a bad thing in the sense that I'm convinced that what the average or maybe all organizations need to develop is this strategic competence. I think they need to be able to do it themselves. And this is something that is maybe my biggest ambition, intention, or driver, is getting more companies to develop that competence to do it themselves. But we're still very far from that. And one of the reasons is that what we do at the university in research and teaching is nowhere near to being really useful to build that competence. So the way I taught strategy in the past, when I was like a young assistant professor, it's, I think, how it's still done and how many people have done it. Use a textbook, and there's kind of a model on every page. And this is filling in the models is what the strategy course is. That's interesting sometimes, but not really useful. It's not an entire approach. It's not an integrative approach. This has driven me to do what I do, to write the books, like, because I could not find a single book with an integrated approach to actually do this in practice. So there's a lot of stuff simply not there. So we, no wonder that organizations have not built up that competence yet, because where should they develop that competence? Where should they learn that? There's hardly a place where you can really learn that.
I completely agree. I've been through plenty of 2 or 3 day strategy workshops led by a facilitator like yourself. And I think unless you have an inclination to understand not just, you know, SWOT, PESL, 7S, RIO, you name it, but you go beyond that and you want to be able to frame that around or wrap that around your existing world, I think it's very difficult to internally build that competence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the interesting thing is that for quite a long time, not anymore, but up to like two, three years ago, my main source of new clients was from the executive MBA teaching I did. So those are experienced managers, executives, sometimes owners of a company who have followed an entire MBA, and part of that being my strategy course, where I basically taught from my book, this is how I do it, here are the steps, and then like 7 weeks for half a day, so pretty extensive training to basically tell them, this is how you can do this yourself. And then that has been, let's say, my most important source of new clients, because then they said, I've tried it, kind of work, but not really, so please help me out, because you seem to be able to do this. That shows, and of course, it's with every skill that you truly master, it takes a lot of effort, it takes a lot of time, it takes years and years and years and lots of experience to build that competence. And as an organizational leader, you also need like 25 other competences. So I can imagine that this part is not easy to simply add.
Yeah, I think that I think it pays. There's a lot of attention to be gained from people like yourselves with companies that need that guidance. Because to your point, if you're a leader, you have several things that you need to be doing in the day. Also looking ahead into the future, and where do you find time to have breakfast and go to sleep, and you know, just kind of to be able to pick yourself up out of the day-to-day and think in a way that you encourage must be difficult. And that makes me think about something that we often hear about, which is the strategy to execution gap.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested to get your thoughts on this, your own. We seldom see that there's some sort of formal tool out there that can benchmark someone's ability to actually execute on their strategy.
Mm-hmm.
But on top of that, the ability to create, to formulate that strategy and see it all the way through from the formulation through to the execution to the continuous development of that strategy and reinforcement of it. Why do you think that there's perhaps not a tool out there that has been able to baseline, whether it's in an industry or if it's in a market size? Like, why do you think there's not a tool out there that's done that?
And with done that, you mean diagnose what the cause or what the gap is? Is that what you mean?
Diagnosing the gap, but then also being able to roll that out consistently to build up more and more data so that a company can know, okay, we started off with I'm just making this up, out of 10, we know that our rating right now is 4. We want to get to 10, but we need to get to 6 first, and this is how we're going to do it.
Yeah, there's probably not one answer. I think there's many factors at play here. I think, of course, there are lots of like software approaches to performance management or OKRs, KPIs, all of that. There's like huge numbers of software to measure progress and so on. But apparently that's not the solution. At least that's not the full solution, because despite having that, it doesn't work. For me, part of an important part of the problem starts in the, let's say, if we want to split the process in two, like generation and execution, it starts in the first half. In if we look at what people call strategy, so they've gone through whatever strategy formulation, generation, formation process, and then the end result is often not, surprisingly, not a strategy. It's a bunch of objectives, and sometimes good objectives, and they might even fit neatly together. But for me, strategy is about what's your business logic? What is, how do you create and capture value? And this is, if you look at the sketch again that I refer to, this is what it reflects. It's what's your value creation and capturing logic. And many, many strategies that I've seen do not explain that. And if they explain, and that's maybe the second problem with the strategies and the plans that I've seen, is that they are not detailed enough. There's this nice idea that strategy should be simple and you should be able to phrase it in a sentence and write it down on a page. Very well. And if you can't summarize it in a sentence and you can't put it on a page, it's probably a problem. But if that's the only thing you have, it's a problem as well. Because then the switch or the translation from this very, very high level summary to what do we need to do as a HR department, as a marketing department, as the product X division. So that translation, the cascading is far too, the gap is far too big. So the strategy is much too abstract. So what I try to do is kind of develop executable strategy. So which is strategy that's already pretty concrete, that when you see it, you know, okay, this is what's different from today, and this is what we can do in order to get there. And so the irony is that, and I think one of the quotes or mottos I've used in my book is like going fast by taking it slow, something like that. Too many companies, after having invested a lot of time and effort into the strategy formation part, they've become impatient. So now we want results. And then, when I get in, then I often have to say, okay, to me, it seems we're still in this first phase. We need to do it not so much again, but we need to refine it with one level. And when you jump from this high level strategy to execution, that's where the problem starts. So we need to develop the steps in between as well. So make it tangible, make it concrete, make it specific details, so that people understand what it really means. And understanding what it means what's the difference, and what are the actions needed, and what does it mean for me, for my department, for my unit, for my division. So there's a lot of stuff like kind of in between that doesn't happen, and that's it creates, I think, a lot of, not all, but a lot of the problems in execution.
I love what you said there about going fast but taking it slow. I'm not quite sure it's exactly the same, but I when I'm in strategy sessions internally, I talk about we should be aspirational in our direction, but pragmatic in how you get there. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably the same sort of intent. On that topic, in terms of the gap that exists, from your experiences, what are the telltale signs of a healthy environment where you know the execution is going to be successful versus more than likely going to be unsuccessful?
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of them are just signs of what is a healthy organization, at least my view on what is a healthy organization. So I think openness, transparency, safety, feedbacks are safe to give feedbacks, safe to share your opinion, safe to take a risk. So that kind of openness, transparency, safety is one of them. Because if you don't have that, no one will tell you you're wrong and people will not share information and so on. Related is having kind of a decentralized structure, have autonomy, freedom, with responsibility and accountability. So not a top-down hierarchy where you just do as you're told or pretend you do as you're told, but serious autonomy and responsibility for your job. So like a modern day workplace where we treat people as adults. That's, I think that's basically, once openness, transparency, the freedom, those are very important conditions. And I think what you need is a process in place for absorbing and executing new things. So in one of my posts a while ago, I've kind of put like, let's do execution before strategy. And of course, technically, formally, that's impossible because you can't execute what you have not. But what I mean is it's probably best to first make sure you have a process in place, a communication structure, a way of measuring meetings, where whatever new strategy comes in, whatever new idea comes in, you can process it. Because most organizations that I know are organized to basically maintain the status quo and deliver what they normally do. And there is no standardized process for bringing in new things. And I think we need this dual process where, you do have your kind of production process where you deliver the current products, the current services in an efficient and effective way. But you also need, I think at every level, at every department, at every function, a process, okay, there's always new things. How do we embrace the new things? How do we add them, or how do we replace some of the current things by the new things? And that, having that process in place, I think once you have that, you're kind of strategy execution ready. And then I think that that's a very important way of smoothening this gap and avoiding this. And also to become flexible in whatever strategy change is made, you're prepared to move. You're prepared to absorb that idea, that change, and execute on it.
I sense that flexibility, adaptability, however you want to describe it, is something that is not necessarily built into certain types of organization. And the reason I say that is, with manufacturing organizations, they're typically control-based. They're control-based environments where it's top-down, whereas with tech, you're more likely going to see a more distributed structure where, mm-hmm. to your point, your own, you have the right environment and people are empowered, but they're accountable. What do you think is behind the difference between those organizations that are in manufacturing, for instance, that's more controlled and more top-down versus mm-hmm. tech, where it's all about agility, get things done, you're empowered, but you need to be able to deliver X, Y, and Z?
Mm-hmm. Part of it is probably history, because I think if you look at the average ages of these companies, I would bet that the manufacturing companies on average are older. So they've developed in, let's say, with more traditional ways of looking at how do you organize, how do you lead a company, more, let's say, the typical organizational structure. And the tech software companies are much younger, so that's one. The other is, I think, investment. When you have to build a 10 million factory or a 50 million factory, experimenting, trial and error is a very expensive thing to do. So with software, of course, and with other, you can play much more around and have quick releases. So there's some of it is in the nature of the business and the industry. Some of it is in the history. And maybe the true answer is probably somewhere in the middle for both of them, because one of the things that I've also seen is too much emphasis on agility and adaptiveness is also not necessarily the best approach, because it creates a lot of stress and uncertainty for people, and you might risk of drifting from one goal to the next, to the next, to the next. And especially for strategy, this is interesting, because the whole idea of agile strategy or adaptive strategy is kind of a paradox or a contradiction. Because if you look at why we have strategy and where the whole idea of strategy comes from, it is actually to give some stability in a fast-changing, complex, uncertain environment. So if you go back to the 1970s, that's where the term strategy was basically introduced into business. So like 50 years ago, not 2000 years ago with Sun Tzu, but 50 years ago, then when we started to rebrand this field as strategy. And if you read early articles from that time, it's all about how do we deal with this uncertain environment? And how do we make sure we don't just move into unguided execution? So we need some stability, we need some guidance. So if we take strategy kind of full circle back to being completely agile, we lose the essence of what strategy was in the first place. So it's balancing this stability and flexibility. And one of the things I often say is monitor actively. So have very much an agile mindset when you stay abreast of what's happening inside your organization, outside your organization, but change reluctantly. So monitor actively, change reluctantly, because if you can, it probably makes sense to stay on course, to keep to your goals, your ambitions, your intention, until you can't do that anymore, until the real world shows that you need to change. So balance, I think that's the, for both types of organization, it's probably kind of the in-between structure that would be most beneficial in the long run.
When you talk about being agile in terms of monitoring your environment, for our listeners, what would you, two parts here. First and foremost, what would you be looking to monitor? And then secondly, how often would you be monitoring it?
Mm-hmm. For what? My answer is going to be boring. And this is, I always also warn my students and with the people I work with, I'm going to brainwash you with my strategy sketch, with the tool that I've developed for a reason, because that's I think why it is such a powerful tool, because it helps to diagnose and assess your current strategy. It helps to design, but it's also like a checklist for monitoring what's going on. So what I recommend anyone is use a tool like that to check like, okay, these 10 elements on the customer side, on the competition side, on the revenue model side, on the organizational climate side, what's going on? And then the monitor actively and change reluctantly comes in. We want to be fully abreast on what's going on in these 10 elements. And then always ask the question, okay, has something changed here? Okay, can we keep the rest intact, or do we need to change some of the other elements as well? And in terms of frequency, what I would recommend is do it informally all the time, so on a day-to-day basis. So if the way I think my brain is almost wired with the 10 elements of the sketch in probably hardwired, even if you would study it. But it's whenever I hear people talk about a company, I kind of check off the boxes. I've heard about this, I've heard about that, but not yet about that. So I know what to ask. And I think in the same way, you can follow the news. You can follow what you hear from customers, from competition, what you read in the newspapers, and constantly kind of relate that to these 10 elements. So that's the informal passive reactive approach. For the rest, depends of course a bit on the speed of your industry. If there's lots of changes, you want to do it more frequent. Generally probably once a quarter, half a year to a year, and maybe quarterly more briefly, more as a check, and every year more formally, and at every couple of years really kind of redefine. So what I typically would do is like every year, so do a quick update every quarter, just to make sure that if anything important has happened, do we need to pivot? Preferably not, but if we have, we have to. Every year, a bit more serious, but still with the intention to stay on course. And then every couple of years, kind of redo your strategy with the intention, like, okay, let's start from scratch in our mind, of course, and see whether if we would design it now, how would we do it? To also make sure that you don't just stay in the incremental change, which might be a dead end at some point in time, so that every couple of years you really rethink your strategy. And even then, the best outcome would be we can stay on course, but then you really challenge So different degrees. So there's different frequencies and different degrees of how serious you you're doing this.
When we talk to our audience, because we have spoken around adaptive strategy, I think what I have gathered from speaking to our audience is that, you know, what you're saying there is true, your own, in that sometimes change is not necessary, when in reality it's staying the course, and really, if you have that regular check-in on a quarterly basis, it should enable you to at least build up the intelligence to know that, okay, at the end of the year, what did we see? What were these small things that we saw? Behind all of this, ultimately, are people. And while a framework is fantastic and technology is brilliant, it's people that that is the essence of strategy. People are fueling strategy's success. I've heard you talk about a human-centered approach to strategy. Could you just talk a little bit about what that means in your eyes?
Yeah, of course. Of course, strategy has always been kind of human-centered, because indeed, there's no way around doing this without, you can't do this without people. But I think it has become too much of a kind of rational analytic approach. We're gathering lots of data, especially external data, has been almost the most important part. So all kind of trends analysis, predictions, scenarios, and so on, preferably objective. And let's put that in air quotes, because objective, yeah, what is objective? There's always there has been a reason why this data has been gathered, and you can present it in the way you like it. So there's a lot of subjectivity involved there. What we have, I think, undervalued is, let's say, the whole person that we bring to the table, which means not just our left brain, not the analytical rational part, but our right brain, the holistic, integrative, synergistic thinking, creative thinking. I think that's extremely important in strategy. But if you look at the average strategy tool, it's more analytic. So there's a strong bias towards left brain versus right brain. Also, we've become suspicious of feelings, emotions, judgments. Well, I think this subjective side of strategy is extremely important, because who cares about what is objectively true in a strategy? Because it's about the future anyway, so you don't know whether it's true. And in the end, I think what is more important is, do people believe in it? Are they convinced it will work? And if they are convinced, and if you have a strong team that together is convinced that this will work, it's most likely going to happen. Of course, within the boundaries of natural laws and so on. But the conviction, the being convinced, the energy, the motivation is so much more important. Also, the strategy process, the emphasis has very much been on the cognitive analytical side, the content side. Like, we need to come up with a good strategy, and a good strategy means according to these objective criteria, often financial, it's going to make us more money and more profits. But the social side, the facts, and this is why I use the participative approach that I described, going through this process together, making sense of what the company is doing together, aligning your views, hearing each other, listening to each other, together crafting a future view about the future, about the strategy of the organization. The social side of that is critical. And that's also part of the human-centered approach to strategy, because strategy, more often than not, has a profound impact on people's positions, their power, their relationships, their work. So ignoring all of that is almost a guarantee for failed execution. So you can't craft a strategy, let's say, from a drawing board, isolated from the company, even if it leads to a great strategy, as in the right one fitting the company, because people have not had the time to learn about it, to absorb it, to contribute it. So there's lots of, let's say, human aspects that we, once we bring those into the strategy process, think we will end up with much better strategies, but also smoother execution for all these many different reasons.
I think that I have seen environments where what you're talking about there doesn't exist, and I've seen environments where what you're talking about there does exist, and it's a night and day difference. Whether I have been in a role where I've had a strategy pushed down, or I've been pushing the strategy up, or you know, distributing it, I think it makes a world of difference to, as you say, not be so focused upon what is objective and what is data, and more subjectivity is perhaps lost in this world. And we talk a lot about Hoshin Kanri with its catchable process. I think that has the ability, and we certainly have used that within 9X, that has the ability to get people involved in the conversation and to be able to, providing the environment's correct, and it is, but providing the environment's correct, you can contribute, you can share your opinion. And I think it's those moments that honestly make the difference between something that is likely going to be executed well, at least in the places that I've worked, versus those that are probably going to have to be revisited because they're just not coming to reality. How can you develop a healthy environment where you are able to have a human-centered approach to strategy?
Treat your people like you would like to be treated. That's kind of... Yeah, it starts with leadership. It starts with I think the only way of achieving this is if leaders with a strong preference at the top are convinced that this is the way of doing it, and also live it, because otherwise it's pretty hopeless. And then if you're not in a position to influence that, I think you have two choices. One is for your part of the company that you're responsible for, so focus on your sphere of influence, your circle of influence, do it there and kind of ignore the rest if you manage, or leave and go somewhere else and where there's a better environment, because it's a fruitless attempt if top leadership is not convinced that this is the way to do it. It's unless you have too much energy and patience and a willingness to change that, I think it's pretty fruitless attempt. So yeah, either focus on those parts where you can kind of create the environment yourself with the people you work with, and maybe be even a kind of a boundary between that little group or that bigger group and the larger corporate world you're in. Or if you even can't do that because of all the procedures and formal systems, my choice would be leave and go somewhere, because there's plenty of organizations that have a better culture and structure that would love to have you and work with them.
Perhaps on the opposite end of what we're talking about here, the human-centered approach.
Mm-hmm.
It's 2024, and if I don't bring this up, then I'm not doing my job as an interviewer.
Kind of feel where you're going.
Yes, I'm trying to give you a heads up without saying it. What do you sense could be the role that AI plays in this world of strategy and execution?
Yeah, I find that a challenging question, because I'm not a prophet, and I think projections about what technology can do have been notoriously unreliable over the centuries. With that caveat, is it something I've written very recently, last week, actually, when we were recording this, my first post where I said something about AI. And basically what I try to create there is a framework to think about this question. And what I did there is is distinguish two dimensions. One is the cognitive part of strategy, which is, and I used Herbert Simon's process of intelligence design choice, like fundamental process of looking at decisions, and the behavioral side of strategy, where I use the AMO or MOA model with ability, opportunity, motivation. What I think, and this piece was much more meant as a starter of a discussion rather than an answer, is on the intellectual, on the cognitive side, we can probably get quite far. And especially on the intelligence, I think that's where AI is very capable, more capable than we are, because it's algorithmic, it's analytical. I think that's what artificial intelligence can do much more. And but when we move to the design and choice phases of decision making, probably also in the design phase, because we can use AI to generate scenarios. So generative AI, we're discovering that it's not just big numbers and a big power, but it's actually kind of creating, based on all the only inputs, it's creating surprisingly kind of new things. On the choice part, I hope not. What AI can do is the kind of calculate rationally and kind of maybe even predict based on the parameters, like what would be the optimal solution. But in making a choice of what your strategy should be, there's many other factors, including what do we like as people? What inspires us? What motivates us? What do we think is morally, ethically the right thing? What do we think humanity needs? So all of that, I can't see how AI could do that. And I hope it will never, because I think that's what makes our human. So on the cognitive side, pretty far, especially the first, a little bit less the second, and not so much the third phase. On the behavioral side, much less, because in the end, whatever needs to happen, there's people involved executing it. So yes, some jobs AI can do for you, especially like mental work or intellectual work. But hey, we're living in a physical world, so the opportunities created by a market, by other technologies, by natural developments, I don't see so much what AI could do there. And on the motivation side, what really drives us, what drives our behavior, I think very little. So that if you visualize in your head like a 3x3 matrix here, it's kind of green at the origin, where the intelligence and ability are, and it's red on the other side and kind of mixed colors in between. That's the way I look at it now. I might be completely wrong. And also, frankly, my experience is extremely limited in using this. So I could see a point where the work that I do with my clients, as I mentioned, I work with them through a series of sessions where they give their inputs, processing those inputs and turning that into a structured document. I think that's where AI can play an important role, but not in getting people on board and getting them motivated and getting them buy in and having them understand. So, and we need to, so it's again, when we could, we might be able to create a great strategy using AI. If people have not gone through the process of contributing to it, it's still not going to work, because you need that process as well, because that's the behavioral part again. One more answer is because they're currently creating a clone of me in AI. So there's a company doing this and kind of put all my inputs on my posts, my books and so, and then how that, let's say, AI bot would answer if you ask me questions. I've seen a first version, which I did not recognize myself yet, but when more information is uploaded, I can see possibilities there. So there's probably lots of possibilities, but still on the cognitive dimension.
I can't wait to see that bot.
Me neither. So then I can go and retire. I don't have to do anything anymore.
I would tend to lean towards what you're saying there, because there is an element, and it kind of reinforces what we've been talking about today around humans and exploration and the journey and the value that is in opinions just based on your guts and what you've interpreted, that a machine won't be able to do for you. And I think that I want to believe that you're correct. And I think it will be that's the case, in that AI can help to a degree, but there are plenty of things in this world that don't need a computer to tell you to do.
and we might forget the fun part of things. And I think that's also, if you look at it, I've tried to use AI. I've used AI to, I think, for two posts over the past like 1.5 years, just as an experiment to write it for me. It kind of worked, but it feels, yeah, it's like faking. And the reward that I get, the personal reward that I get of producing what I produce, is why I do it. And if I, even if AI can do it, I don't want to do it because it's no fun. And I think that's also, I've seen a recent video by, I think the founder of OpenAI ChatGPT, basically saying that part also, even though AI could write a technically correct and even interesting book, as soon as we find out that it has been written by AI, we kind of lose interest probably because it's not a real person. Again, I might be completely wrong, and like a couple of years from now, what bullshit is this? it's still valuable, but I think still believe like the human touch, human relations, that part stays important. And it, because every technology over the past centuries, I think we have thought that okay, this is going to make us superfluous as human beings, and kind of feel the same with AI. Of course, it can do, can get much closer. But the good thing would be that we can even focus more on the human side of business, the human side of strategy, and really have human-centered organizations.
I would hope so. But to bring it back round full circle, before we close up this episode, mm-hmm. speaking of fun, please, can you tell me, our audience, all about your new book?
Yeah, which is not out yet. So my newest book that is out is the 1 Hour Strategy. So that's the process that we talked about largely today, is how do you make this like a corporate company-wide process, everyone's job. But the new book is basically a collection of, let's say, my best LinkedIn work of the past year. Because people have requested that. I didn't think of it myself, but I've got several requests. People like, hey, you have all these interesting visuals and the posts, and is there a book? So the first couple of times I had to say no, but then, okay, if people are even asking for it, why not? So I've created, it's going to be, the title is going to be The Strategic Leadership Playbook, Volume 1, because I anticipate there's going to be a series, because I keep on posting on a weekly basis, or a couple of days per week, basically containing the most successful posts with some extra information. So for each of those tools, there also is a 5-step how-to. So it's even more practical than my posts. Probably comes out in March or so. I don't dare to say an exact date, but maybe once this is out, it's already there. And it will only be available through LinkedIn. Not on Amazon or any of the other ordinary book channels, because the origin is LinkedIn. The reason I'm making it is because of my followership on LinkedIn. So I thought it would be appropriate to also make it available there.
That is brilliant. I think it's a very creative way of using the content that you're already producing and adding extra value. And listeners, you can be sure that we will share a link to Yaron's LinkedIn, and you'll be able to find out more details about the Strategic Leadership Playbook Volume 1. I'm sure there'll be many, many volumes to come.
I hope so.
So in closing our episodes, we often ask one question, and sometimes it stumps our guests. Other times they can just rattle off an answer straight away.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, if you had to give one piece of advice to a leader or an organization around strategy and execution,
mm-hmm.
that be?
Trust your guts. And this aligns with the, let's say, the overemphasis on data and analytics. And I think we have become very suspicious about gut feel, to the extent that if what is normal, what is expected, what is the data telling us, if you don't trust it, if it doesn't feel right, it's probably not right. So this is, I've learned that, maybe not the hard way, but through experience in my career, but also personally, when it doesn't feel right, yeah, really, it's probably not right. And when it feels right, even though you cannot explain why it is right, it is probably right. So trust your gut feel, your intuition, your instincts, whatever you call it, in how you lead, in what you think are the the best decisions and the things that you should do, the things that you shouldn't do. Trust your instincts.
Well, Yaron, thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. Trust your guts. Thank you so much for joining us for today's episode. If anyone wants to learn more about Yaron and his upcoming book or his existing books, you can find that out with the link that's in the body of this episode in your favorite podcast player. Yaron, thank you so much for being our strategy hero for the day.
Thank you, James, for asking these wonderful questions.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.